fell in stark slabs of light in the abbey churchyard. It was so dazzling he had to shield his eyes with his hand.
"Could I ask you all to form a proper line?"
Glancing behind, Harold found himself included in a party of foreign tourists, wearing canvas sun hats and visiting the Roman baths. Their guide was an English girl, barely out of her teens, with a fragile face and an upper-class trill to her voice. Harold was about to explain he was not one of the party when she confessed that this was her first tour as a professional.
"None of them has a clue what I'm talking about," she whispered.
She sounded so startlingly like Maureen as a young woman that he couldn't move. Her mouth wobbled as if she were about to cry, and Harold was undone. He tried lingering at the back, and also attaching himself to a party who were almost finished, but each time he was on the verge of escape, he remembered his young wife in her blue coat, and couldn't let the guide down. 2 hours later, her tour ended in the gift shop, where he bought postcards and mosaic key rings for both Maureen and Queenie. He had especially enjoyed her introduction to the sacred spring, he told her. They really were extremely clever, the Romans. The young guide gave a slight wriggle of her nose, as if she had smelt something unpleasant, and asked if he had considered visiting the nearby Thermae Bath Spa, where he might enjoy picturesque views of the city and a state-of-the-art cleansing experience. Appalled, Harold rushed straight there. He had been careful to keep washing both his clothes and himself, but his shirt was frayed at the collar and his fingernails were dirt ridges. It was only once he had paid for his entrance ticket and the hire of towels that it occurred to him he had no trunks. For these he had to leave and find a nearby sports shop, making the day his most expensive so far. The assistant fetched a choice of bathing costumes and goggles, although when Harold explained he was more of a walker than a swimmer, she was keen to show him waterproof covers for his compass and a selection of reduced-price all-weather trousers. By the time he left the shop with his swimming shorts in a small bag, a large crowd was packed on the pavement. Harold found himself squashed against a copper statue of a Victorian man in a top hat.
"We're waiting for that famous actor," explained a woman beside him.
Her face was red and filmy with the heat.
"He's signing his new book. If he catches my eye, I shall pass out."
It was difficult to see the really famous actor, let alone catch his eye, because he seemed to be rather short and surrounded by a wall of bookshop assistants in black uniforms. The crowd shouted out and applauded. Photographers held up their cameras and the street was punctured with flashlight. Harold wondered what it must be like to have made such a success of your life. The woman beside him was saying she had named her dog after the actor. The dog was a cocker spaniel, she said. She wished she could tell the actor. She had read all about him in magazines. She knew him like a friend. Harold tried to lean against the statue for a better look, but the statue gave him a sharp dig in the ribs. The bleached sky shone. Sweat broke out on Harold's neck and slid from his armpits, clamping his shirt to his skin. By the time Harold made it back to the spa, a flock of young women on a hen party were playing in the water, and he didn't want to alarm them or get in the way, so he took a quick steam and left in a hurry. At the pump room, he asked if he might take a sample of the health-giving water to a very good friend in Berwick-upon-Tweed. The waiter poured some into a bottle and charged £5 because Harold had mislaid his ticket for the Roman baths. It was already early afternoon, and he needed to get back on the road. In the public lavatories, Harold found himself washing his hands next to the actor from the book signing. He was wearing a leather jacket and trousers and cowboy boots with a small heel. The man stared at his face in the mirror, pulling at the skin, as if he were checking it for something missing. Close up, his hair was so dark it looked plastic. Harold didn't want to intrude on the actor. He dried his hands and pretended he was thinking of something else.
"Don't tell me you have a dog named after me as well," said the actor. He was staring straight up at Harold. "Today I'm not in the mood."
He told the actor he didn't have a dog. As a child, he added, he had been bitten many times by a Pekingese called Chinky. This was probably not politically correct. The aunt who owned him had not troubled herself with other people's feelings.
"But I have been walking, and I have met some nice dogs recently."
The actor returned to his reflection. He continued to talk about the dog-naming issue, as if Harold's interjections about his aunt had not been made.
"Every day someone comes up to tell me about their dog and how they've given it my name. They say it as if I should be happy. They haven't the first idea."
Harold agreed this was unfortunate, although secretly he thought it must be flattering. He couldn't imagine anyone calling their pet Harold, for instance.
"I spent years doing serious work. I did a whole season at Pitlochry. Then I make one costume drama and that's it. Everyone in the country thinks it's original to name a dog after me. Did you come to Bath for my book?"
Harold admitted he hadn't. He told the actor the barest details about Queenie. He didn't think he should mention the nurses he had imagined applauding as he arrived at the hospice. The actor appeared to be listening, although at the end of the story he asked again if Harold had a copy of the book and if he would like the actor to sign it. Harold agreed. He felt the book might be a perfect souvenir for Queenie. She had always liked reading. He was about to ask the actor if he wouldn't mind waiting while he nipped out to buy a copy, but the actor spoke instead.
"Actually, don't bother. It's rubbish. I haven't written a word of the thing. I haven't even read it. I'm a serial shagger with a serious coke habit. I went down on a woman last week and discovered she had a cock. They don't put that sort of thing in the book."
"No." Harold glanced at the door.
"I'm on all the chat shows. I'm in all the magazines. Everyone thinks I'm this really nice guy, and yet no one knows the first thing about me. It's like being two people. You're probably about to tell me you're a journalist."
He laughed, but there was something both reckless and grim about the gesture that reminded Harold of David.
"I'm not a journalist. I think I would make a very poor one. Tell me again why you're walking to Bradford."
Harold said something quiet about Berwick and atoning for the past. He was unnerved by the very famous actor's confession, and was still trying to find a place in himself in which to keep it.
"So how do you know this woman is waiting? Has she sent a message?"
"A message?" repeated Harold. Although he hadn't misheard, it was more a stalling for time.
"Has she told you she's up for it?"
Harold opened his mouth and reworked it several times. But he couldn't get the words to come.
"How does it work, exactly?"
said the actor. Harold touched his tie with his fingertips. "I send postcards. I know she's waiting." Harold smiled, and the actor smiled too. He wanted the actor to be persuaded by what he had heard, because he wasn't sure there was any other way of putting it. And for a moment it appeared that the actor was. But then a scowl crept over his face, as if he had just tasted something not right.
"If I were you, I'd get myself in a car."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Bollocks to the walk."
Harold's voice trembled.
"The walk is the idea. That's how she will live. John Lennon lay in a bed once. My son had a picture of him on his wall." "John Lennon had Yoko Ono and the world's press in the bed as well. You're on your own, slogging to Berwick-upon-Tweed. It's going to take weeks. And supposing she didn't get your message? They might have forgotten to tell her."
The actor's mouth arched in a frown, as if he were thinking through the implications of such a mistake.
"What does it matter if you walk or get a lift? It makes no difference how you get there. You've just got to see her. I'll lend you my car, my driver. You could be there tonight."
The door opened, and a gentleman in shorts made his way to the urinal. Harold waited for him to finish. He needed the very famous actor to know that you could be ordinary and attempt something extraordinary, without being able to explain it in a logical way. But all he could picture was a car driving to Berwick. The actor was right. Harold had left a message and sent postcards. But there was no proof she had taken him seriously, or even heard about his call. He imagined sitting in the warmth of the car. If he said yes, He could be there in hours. He had to grip his hands to stop them from shaking.
"I haven't upset you, have I?"
said the actor. His voice was suddenly tender.
"I told you I was an ass."
Harold shook his head, but kept it bowed. He hoped the gentleman in shorts wasn't looking.
"I have to keep walking," he said quietly, although he knew he was no longer certain.
The newcomer placed himself between Harold and the actor in order to wash his hands. He began to laugh, as if remembering something private. Then he said,
"I've got to tell you, we have this dog."
Harold made his way to the street. The sky had filled with a dense layer of white cloud that pressed down on the city, as if intending to squeeze the life out of it. Bars and cafes spilled onto the pavements. Drinkers and shoppers were stripped to vests, and skin that had not felt the sun for months was crimson. Harold carried his jacket over his arm, but he frequently had to mop his face with his shirt sleeve. Seed heads hung in the stiff air like fuzz. When Harold got to the cobbler, it was still closed. The straps of his rucksack were wet from his body and dug into his shoulders. It was too hot to keep walking, and he hadn't the energy. He thought he might take refuge in the abbey. He hoped it might be cool there, and inspire him again, remind him what it was to believe in something. But the abbey was closed to visitors for a music rehearsal. Harold sat in a pocket of shade and briefly watched the copper statue, until a small child burst into tears because it had waved and offered her a boiled sweet. He would wait in a small tea shop, where he reckoned he could afford a pot of tea for one. The waitress scowled.
"We don't do drinks only in the afternoon. You have to have the Regency bath cream tea."
But he was already sitting down. Harold asked for the Regency bath cream tea. The tables were set too close together, and the heat was so solid you could almost see it. Customers sat with their legs open and flapped the air with their laminated menus. When his order arrived, a small scoop of clotted cream swam in a pool of fat. The waitress said,
"Enjoy."
Harold asked if she knew the quickest route towards Stroud, but she shrugged.
"Do you mind sharing?"
she said, only without making it sound like a question. She called out to a man at the door and pointed at the seat opposite Harold's. The man sat apologetically and pulled out a book. He had a neatly chiselled face and closely cut light hair. His white shirt was open at the collar, revealing a perfect V-shape of toffee-coloured skin. Asking Harold to pass the menu, he also asked if he liked Bath. He was an American, he said, doing England. His girlfriend was currently enjoying the Jane Austen experience. Harold wasn't sure what this might be, but hoped for her sake that it didn't involve the very famous actor. He was relieved that they fell into silence. He didn't need another encounter like the one in Exeter, or even the one he had just had. Despite his obligation to other people, he wished at that moment he had walls. Harold drank his tea, but couldn't face the scones. He felt dulled with such apathy it was like being at the brewery again in the years following Queenie's departure. Like being an empty space inside a suit that said words sometimes and heard them, that got in a car every day and returned home, but was no longer connected up to other people. The manager appointed after Napier suggested Harold should take a back seat until his retirement. Filing, he suggested. The odd piece of consultative advice. Harold was given a special desk with a computer and his name on a badge, but no one had approached. He draped a serviette over his plate and caught the eye of the chiselled man opposite.
"Too hot for food," said the man.
Harold agreed. He instantly regretted it. The chiselled man now seemed to feel obliged to make further conversation.
"Bath seems like a nice place," he said.
He closed his book.
"Are you on vacation?"
Reluctantly, Harold explained his story, but kept it brief. He left out, for instance, the detail about the garage girl and how she had saved her aunt. Instead, he added that after his son left Cambridge, he had gone on a walking trip to the Lake District. Although he wasn't sure how much hiking he had done, David had returned home and not moved for weeks.
"Is your son joining you?" said the man.
Harold said he wasn't. He asked the American what he did for a living.
"I'm a physician."
"I met a Slovakian lady who is a doctor. She can only get cleaning work. What sort of physician are you?"
"An oncologist."
Harold felt his blood quicken, as if he had unintentionally broken into a run.
"Gosh," he said.
It was clear neither man knew what to say next.
"Goodness."
The oncologist raised his shoulders and gave a regretful smile, as if he wished he could be something else. Harold glanced round for the waitress, but she was fetching water for another customer. His head was dizzy with the heat, and he dabbed at his forehead. The oncologist said,
"Do you know what sort of cancer your friend has?"
"I'm not sure. In her letter she says there's nothing else they can do. She doesn't say any more than that." He felt so exposed, the oncologist might as well have been probing at Harold's skin with his scalpel. He loosened his tie and then his collar. He wished the waitress would hurry.
"Lung cancer?"
"I really don't know."
"May I see her letter?"
He didn't want to show it. The oncologist was holding out his empty hand. Harold reached into his pocket and found the envelope. He adjusted the sticking plaster on his reading glasses, but his face was so slick with moisture he had to hold them in place. He wiped the table with his sleeve, and then again with his napkin, before unfolding the pink sheet of paper and smoothing it flat. Time seemed to stop. Even as the oncologist reached for the letter and gently eased it closer, Harold's right fingers hovered over the page. He read Queenie's words as the oncologist read them. He felt he had to protect the letter, and that by not letting it out of his sight, he could do that. His eye fell on the postscript. No need to reply. After that came an untidy squiggle, as if someone had made a mistake with their left hand. The oncologist threw himself back in his chair and blew out a sigh.
"What a moving letter."
Harold nodded. He replaced his reading glasses in his shirt pocket.
"And beautifully typed," he said. "Queenie was always neat. You should have seen her desk."
At last he smiled. It was going to be all right. The oncologist said,
"But I assume a care worker did it for her."
"I'm sorry?" Harold's pulse stopped.
"She won't be well enough to sit in an office typing letters. Someone at the hospice will have done it for her. It's nice she managed the address, though. You can see she really tried."
The oncologist gave a smile that was plainly intended to be reassuring, but it remained fixed on his face, looking like something forgotten or even misplaced. Harold took up the envelope. The truth dropped like a terrible weight straight through him, and everything seemed to fall away. He didn't know any more if he was unbearably hot or freezing cold. Fumbling again with his reading glasses, he saw now what he had not been able to make sense of. The thing that had been wrong all along. How had he not realized it before? It was the childlike handwriting, with its downward slant and almost comical irregularity. It was the same as the messy squiggle at the bottom of the letter, which, now that he looked again, he found was a botched attempt at her name. This was Queenie's handwriting. This was what she had become. Harold replaced the letter in its envelope, although his fingers were trembling so hard he couldn't get the corner to fit. He had to take it out and fold it again and give it another push. After a long moment, the oncologist said,
"How much do you know about cancer, Harold?"
Harold gave a yawn to stifle the emotion building up inside his face, while gently and slowly, the oncologist told how a tumour is formed. He didn't rush, he didn't flinch. He explained how a cell may reproduce uncontrollably to form an abnormal mass of tissue. There were more than 200 types of cancer, he said, each with different causes and symptoms. He described the difference between primary and secondary cancers, and how ascertaining the origin of the tumour dictated the type of treatment. He explained how, when a new tumour forms on a distant organ, it will behave like the original tumour. A breast cancer growing in the liver, for instance, would not be liver cancer. It would be primary breast cancer, with secondary breast cancer in the liver. But once other organs were involved, the symptoms could get worse. And once a cancer had begun to spread beyond its original site, it became more difficult to treat. If it had got into her lymphatic system, for instance, the end would be quick. Although with the immunity so low, another infection might kill her first. Even a cold, he said. Harold listened without moving.
I'm not saying cancer can't be cured. And when surgery fails, there are alternative treatments. But as a physician, I would never tell a patient there was nothing to be done unless I was absolutely certain. Harold, you have a wife and son. If I may say so, you look tired. Is it really necessary to walk?
Out of words, Harold stood. He reached for his jacket and slipped his arms into the sleeves, but he kept missing one of them, and the oncologist had to stand to help.
Good luck, he said, holding out his hand. And please let me take the bill. It's the least I can do.
For the rest of the afternoon, Harold continued to tread the streets, but without knowing where he was going. He needed someone to share his faith in his walk, so that he could believe in it too. But he barely had the energy to talk. He finally got his shoes resoled. He bought a new box of plasters to keep him going as far as Stroud. He stopped for a takeaway coffee and briefly mentioned Beric, but nothing about how he was getting there or why. No one said what he longed to hear. No one said, "You are going to get there and Queenie will live." No one said, "There will be crowds applauding because this, Harold, is the best idea we have ever heard. You must definitely finish." Harold tried to speak to Maureen, but worried he was taking up her time. He felt he had mislaid all the normal words and the everyday questions that would lead to an exchange of commonplaces, so that speaking caused further pain. He told her he was doing splendidly. He found the courage to hint that a few people had expressed doubt, hoping Maureen would laugh it away, but instead she said, "Yes, I see."
"I don't even know she's..." Again the words ran out.
"She's what?"
"Still waiting."
"I thought you did."
"Not really."
"Have you stayed with any more Slovakian ladies?"
"I met a physician, and a very famous actor."
"Goodness," said Maureen with a laugh. "Wait till I tell Rex." A bald, thick-set man wearing a patterned frock trudged past the kiosk. People were slowing to point him out and laugh. The buttons on the dress strained at his belly, and his eye was a large, closed-up bruise from a recent punch. Harold wished he hadn't seen, but he had. And he knew it would be unbearable for a while to keep thinking of the man, but that he would do it all the same. "Are you sure you're all right?" said Maureen.
Along came another pause, and he was suddenly afraid he was going to cry. So he told her someone else was waiting for the phone and that he must get going. There was a red stretch in the western sky, and the sun was beginning to sink.
"Well, cheerio," said Maureen. For a long time he sat on a bench close to the abbey, trying to work out where to go. It was as if Harold had taken off his jacket, followed by his shirt, and then several layers of skin and muscle. Even the most ordinary things seemed overwhelming. A shop assistant began to wind up the striped awning, and it made such a rattle the noise cut into his head. He looked along the empty street, knowing no one, having nowhere to belong. when emerging from the opposite end, he saw David. Harold stood. His heartbeat came so fast he could feel it in his mouth. It couldn't be his son. He couldn't be in Bath. And yet, looking at the stooped figure striding towards him, tugging on a cigarette, and with his black coat billowing out like wings, Harold knew it was David, and that they were going to meet. He was shaking so much he had to reach for the bench. Even from this distance he could tell David had grown his hair again. Maureen would be so pleased. She had wept bitterly the day he shaved his head. His walk was still the same, toppling and long-paced, his eyes fixed to the ground, his head bowed, as if other people were to be avoided. Harold called out, "David! David!" They were no more than 50 feet apart. His son staggered as if he had lost his balance or tripped. He was maybe drunk, but that wouldn't matter. Harold would buy him a coffee or a drink if he preferred that. They could eat or not eat. They could do whatever his son wanted. "David!" he called. He started to edge towards him, gently, to show he meant no harm. A few more paces. That was all. He remembered the skeletal thinness of David after the Lake District, the way his head balanced on top of his neck, suggesting his body had rejected the rest of the world and was interested only in consuming itself. "David!" he called again, a little louder to make him look up. His son caught his eye, but failed to smile. He glanced at Harold, as if his father wasn't there, or was part of the street but not something he recognized. Harold's insides turned. He hoped he wouldn't fall. It wasn't David. It was someone else. Another man's son. He had allowed himself to believe for a few brief moments that David could appear at one end of a street, while Harold sat at the other. The young man took a sharp right and marched swiftly away, becoming smaller and less distinguishable, until with a snap he turned another corner. Harold kept watching, waiting in case the young man changed his mind and was David after all. But he didn't. It was worse than not seeing his son for 20 years. It was like having him and not having him all over again. Harold returned to the bench outside the abbey, knowing he must find somewhere to sleep, and unable to move. He ended up near the station, in a stuffy room overlooking the road. He wrenched up the sash window for air, but the traffic would not stop and the train shrieked in and out of the platforms. From beyond the wall came a voice in a foreign language shouting into a telephone. Harold lay on a bed that was too soft, where so many people he didn't know had slept before him, listening to the voice he didn't understand, and he was afraid. He got up and paced the room up and down, with the walls too close and the air too still, while the traffic and the trains went to wherever they were going. The past could not be changed. Inoperable cancer could not be cured. He pictured the stranger dressed as a woman, with the blow to his head. He recalled the way David looked the day of his graduation, and in the months following, as if he were asleep with his eyes open. It was too much. It was too much to keep going. As dawn broke, Harold was already on the road, but he did not refer to his compass or his guidebooks. He took all his strength and will to keep putting one foot in front of the other. Only when three teenage girls on horseback asked him the way to Shepton Mallet did he realize he had lost a full day heading in the wrong direction. He sat by the roadside, looking over a field ablaze with yellow flowers. He couldn't remember their name, and he couldn't be bothered to take out his wild plant guide. The truth was, he was spending far too much money. After 3 weeks of walking, Kingsbridge was still nearer than Berwick. The first of the swallows swooped and dived overhead, playing through the air like children. Harold didn't know how he would ever get back on his feet. Chapter 17 Maureen and the Garden.
"Yes, David," Maureen told him. "He's still walking. He rings most evenings, and Rex is being very kind. In a funny way, I'm almost proud. I wish I knew how to tell Harold that."
Lying on the queen-sized bed she had once shared with Harold, she watched the block of bright morning light trapped behind the net curtains. So much had happened in 1 week. She sometimes had the feeling she had slipped into a different woman's skin. "He sends postcards and occasionally a present. He seems to favour pens." She paused, afraid she had offended David because he wasn't replying. "I love you," she said. Her words trickled to nothing, and still he did not speak. "I should let you go," she said at last. It wasn't that it was a relief to stop, but for the first time she had begun to feel uncomfortable when she talked to her son. She had believed they would enjoy a greater intimacy now that Harold was gone. And yet, faced with hours, if she wished, to tell him how things were, she found she was too busy. Or she would speak, and it would dawn on her with creeping certainty that he wasn't listening. She found reasons not to tidy his bedroom. She even stopped thinking she might see him. It was the trip to Slapton Sands that had marked her turning point. That night she had fumbled her front door key into the lock, calling her thank you to Rex across the dividing fence, and then she had climbed the stairs without taking off her shoes and walked straight into the master bedroom. Fully dressed, she had toppled onto the bed and closed her eyes. In the middle of the night, she had realized where she was with a prickle of panic, followed by relief. It was over. She couldn't think exactly what it was, other than an unspecific weight of pain. She had pulled back the duvet and curled into Harold's pillow. It smelt of Pears soap and him. Waking later, she had felt the same lightness spreading through her like warm water. After that, she had carried her clothes in armfuls from the spare room and hung them in the wardrobe, at the opposite end of the rail from Harold's. She had given herself a challenge. Every day without him, she would attempt one new thing. She took the pile of unopened household bills to the kitchen table, along with the checkbook, and began to pay them. She rang the insurance company to make sure Harold's health care was up to date. She drove a car to the garage and had the air levels checked in the tires. She even tied an old silk scarf round her hair, like in the old days. When Rex appeared unexpectedly at the garden fence, she had to shoot her hand up and tug the knot free.
"I look silly," she said.
"Not at all, Maureen."
He appeared to have something on his mind. They would be talking about the garden or Harold's whereabouts, and then a thought would occur to him, and he would go quiet. When she asked if he was all right, he merely nodded.
"Just wait," he'd tell her. "I have a plan up my sleeve."
She had a hunch it was something to do with herself. Dusting behind the nets at the bedroom window the previous week, she couldn't help but notice the postman deliver something in a cardboard tube to Rex's front door. A day later, and from the same vantage point, she had spied Rex struggling up the path with a window-sized piece of board, which he was trying to hide under a tartan blanket from the rover. Maureen was intrigued. She had waited for him in the garden. She even took out a basket of dried washing and pegged it again on the line. But he didn't come out all afternoon. She knocked to ask if he had enough milk, and he mumbled through a crack in the door that he did, and that he was having an early night. And yet when she went to check the back garden at 11 o'clock, the lights were still on in his kitchen, and she could see him pottering about. The next day, a rap at the letterbox had brought her rushing into the hallway, where she found a strange square shape against the bobbled glass, with what looked like a small head floating on top. Opening the door, she discovered Rex behind a large, flat, brown paper package tied with loops of string.
"Do you mind if I come in?"
he said. He could barely get the words out. Maureen couldn't remember the last time someone had given her a gift, when it wasn't Christmas or her birthday. She had ushered him inside and into the sitting room, offering tea or coffee. He insisted there was no time for either. She must open her present.
"Tear the paper, Maureen," he said.
She couldn't. It was too exciting. She had unpeeled one corner of brown paper and found a hard frame of wood. And then she unpeeled the other edge and found the same again. Rex sat with his hands clasped in his lap. And every time she peeled off a new strip, his feet lifted as if he were jumping over an invisible rope, and he gasped.
"Hurry!
Hurry!" he said. "Whatever is it?"
"Pull it out. Go on. Have a proper look, Maureen. I made it for you."
It was a giant-sized map of England mounted on a pinboard. On the back he had attached two small mirror hooks, so that it could be hung from the wall. He pointed to Kingsbridge, and there she found a drawing pin, wound with blue thread, that stretched to Lodiswell. From there the blue thread crept to South Brent, and on again to Buckfast Abbey. Harold's route to date was marked up with blue thread and drawing pins, ending at Bath. At the top of England, Berwick-upon-Tweed was marked with fluorescent green highlighter pen and a small homemade flag. There was even a separate box of drawing pins so that she could display Harold's postcards.
"I thought you could stick them on parts of the country he isn't visiting," said Rex, "like Norfolk and South Wales. I'm sure that will be okay."
Rex put up nails in the kitchen for the map, and they hung it above the table, so that Maureen could see where Harold was and fill in the rest of his journey. It was a little lopsided because he had difficulty with the drill, and the first raw plug was swallowed into the wall. But if she looked at the map with a slight tilt to her head, it was barely noticeable. Besides, as she told Rex, it didn't matter about things not being perfect. This, too, was a new departure for Maureen. After the map present, they had taken an outing every day. She accompanied him to the crematorium with roses for Elizabeth, and afterwards they stopped for tea at Hope Cove. They visited Salcombe and took a boat trip across the estuary, and another afternoon he drove her to Brixham to buy crab. They walked the coastal road towards Bigbury and ate fresh shellfish at the Oyster Shack. He said it was good for him to get out, and that he hoped he wasn't intruding, and she reassured him that it helped her, too, to stop thinking things over. They were sitting in front of the dunes at Bantham when she explained how she and Harold had first come to Kingsbridge 45 years ago, when they were newly married. They had so much hope in those days.
"We knew no one, but it didn't matter. We only needed each other. Harold had a difficult childhood. I think he loved his mother very much, and his father must have had some sort of breakdown after the war. I wanted to be everything he had never had. I wanted to give him a home and a family. I learned to cook, I made curtains, I found wooden crates and hammered them together to make a coffee table. Harold dug me vegetable plots at the front of the house, and I grew everything, potatoes, beans, carrots." She laughed. "We were very happy." It was such a pleasure to voice these things. She wished there were more words. "Very happy," she said again. The tide was so far out, the sand looked glazed under the sun. There was a clear stretch between the shore and Burr Island. People had brought multicoloured windbreaks and small pop-up tents. Dogs were scampering across the sand, in chase of sticks and balls. Children were running up and down with buckets and spades, and far out the sea glittered. She thought of how much David had wanted a dog. Maureen fumbled for her handkerchief
and asked Rex to ignore her. Maybe it was coming to Bantham again after all these years. So many times she had blamed Harold for the day that David almost drowned.
I say so many things that I don't mean. It's as if, even if I think something nice about Harold, by the time it's got to my mouth, it's become not nice. He goes to tell me something, and I'm saying, I think not, before he's finished the sentence.
I always got cross with Elizabeth for leaving the top off the toothpaste. Now I throw it away. As soon as I open a new tube, I find I don't want the lid.
She smiled. His hand was near hers. She brought her own up and fingered the ridge of bone at her throat where the skin was still soft.
When I was young, I looked at people our age and I assumed my life was sorted. It never occurred to me that when I got to 63 I'd be in the most appalling mess.
There were so many things Maureen wished she had done differently. Lying in bed in the morning light, she yawned and stretched, feeling the size of the mattress with her hands and feet, even the cold, far corners. Then she moved her fingers to herself. She touched her cheeks, her throat, the outline of her breasts. She imagined Harold's hands around her waist, his mouth on hers. Her skin was slack, and her fingertips no longer had the sensitivity of a young woman's. But all the same, her heart beat wildly, and her blood throbbed. From outside came the click of Rex's front door closing. She sat up sharply. Moments later, his car started, and she heard him driving away. She curled back into the duvet, pulling it close against her, like a body. The wardrobe door was partly open, revealing the sleeve of one of Harold's left-behind shirts, and she felt a stab of the old pain. She threw back the duvet, seeking distraction. The perfect job presented itself as she passed the wardrobe. For many years, it had been Maureen's system, just as it had been her mother's, to arrange clothing according to the season. Winter items would be placed at one end of the rail, along with thick pullovers, while summer clothing would be hung at the opposite end, beside lightweight jackets and cardigans. Somehow, in her rush to put her own clothes in the wardrobe, she had failed to notice that Harold's clothes hung higgledy-piggledy, with no reference to weather or texture of fabric. She would go through each piece, throwing out those he no longer needed, and hanging the rest properly. There were his work suits, fraying at the lapels. These she lifted out and placed on the bed. There were a number of wool cardigans, all of them thin at the elbow. She would patch those. Skimming through a selection of shirts, some white, some checked, she came across the tweed jacket he had bought especially for David's graduation. She felt a beating against her chest, like something trapped inside. She hadn't cast her eyes on the jacket for years. Maureen eased it off the hanger and held it high in front of her, at Harold level. 20 years fell away, and she saw the two of them again, standing outside King's College Chapel, Cambridge, uncomfortable in their new outfits, in the exact spot where David had instructed them to wait. She saw herself wearing a satin dress with shoulder pads that, now she thought about it, was the colour of a boiled crustacean and probably matched her cheeks. She saw Harold with his shoulders hunched, so that his arms shot out stiffly, as if the jacket sleeves were made of wood, not fabric. It was his fault, she had complained at the time. He should have checked the arrangements. It was nervousness that made her lash out. They had waited for over 2 hours, but it was the wrong place after all. They missed the whole ceremony. And even though David apologized when they bumped into him coming out of a pub, you could excuse him for that, it was a day of celebration, he also failed to meet them for the punting trip he had promised. The couple had made the long drive from Cambridge to Kingsbridge in silence.
"He said he's going on a walking holiday," she said at last.
"That's good.
Just as a stopgap until he gets a job.
That's good, he said again. Tears of frustration had caught like a solid lump in her throat.
At least he has a degree, she fired. At least he can make something of his life.
David returned home 2 weeks later, unexpectedly. He didn't explain why he was back so soon, but he carried a brown holdall that clunked as it hit the banisters, and he often took his mother aside to ask her for money.
University took it out of him, she'd say, to excuse his failure to get up.
Or she'd say,
he just needs to find the right job.
He missed interviews. Or he went to them but forgot to wash and comb his hair.
David is too clever, she'd say.
Harold would nod in that easy way of his, and she'd want to shout at him for appearing to believe her. The truth was, their son could barely stand up straight most of the time. There were moments when she stole a glance at him, and she wasn't even convinced he had graduated. With David, you could look back and there were so many inconsistencies that even the things you thought you knew began to unravel. And then she would feel guilty for doubting her son, and blame it instead on Harold. At least David has prospects, she'd say. At least he has his hair. Anything to throw Harold off balance. Money began to disappear from her purse. First coins, then notes. She pretended they hadn't. Over the years, she had asked David many times if she could have done more. But he had reassured her. After all, it was she who had underlined suitable vacancies in the job section of the newspaper. It was she who had fixed the doctor's appointment and driven him there. Maureen remembered how he dropped the prescription into her lap, as if it were nothing to do with him. There was prothiazide for the depression, and diazepam to decrease anxiety, and then there was temazepam if he still couldn't sleep at night. "That's an awful lot," she had said, scrambling to her feet. "What did the doctor say to you? What does he think?" He had shrugged and lit another cigarette. But at least after that there had been an improvement. She listened out at night, but it seemed he was sleeping. He no longer got up to eat breakfast at 4 in the morning. He no longer went for night walks in his dressing gown or filled the house with the sick, sweet smell of his roll-ups. David was certain he would find a job. She saw him again the day he decided to interview for the army, and took it upon himself to shave his scalp. There were curls of his long hair all over the bathroom. There were nicks in the skin where his hand had trembled and the razor slipped. The barbarity inflicted on that poor head she loved to distraction, had made her want to scream. Maureen lowered herself onto the bed and dropped her face in her hands. What more could they have done?
"Oh, Harold,"
she fingered the coarse tweed of his English gentleman's jacket. An urge came over her to do something completely different. It was like a shock of energy right through her, forcing her once more to her feet. She took out the shrimp garment she had worn for the graduation and hung it at the center of the rail. Then she took Harold's jacket and arranged it on a hanger beside the dress. They looked lonely and too apart. She scooped up his sleeve and draped it over the pink shoulder. After that, she paired each of her outfits with one of his. She tucked the cuff of her blouse in his blue suit pocket. A skirt hem she looped around a trouser leg. Another dress she wrapped in the embrace of his blue cardigan. It was as if lots of invisible Maureens and Harolds were loitering in her wardrobe, simply waiting for the opportunity to step out. It made her smile, and then it made her cry. But she didn't change them back. She was interrupted by the sound of Rex's Rover drawing up outside. Soon afterwards, she was aware of a scraping sound from her front garden. Lifting the net curtains, she found he had marked rectangles of turf with string and posts, and that he was cutting into them with his spade. He waved up at her.
"If we're lucky, we might be in time for runner beans."
Wearing an old shirt of Harold's, Maureen planted 20 small shoots and tied them to bamboo stakes without damaging their soft green stems. She patted the soil at their roots and watered them. At first she watched in fear, lest they were pecked by seagulls or killed by a May frost. But after only a day or so of constant watching, her worry subsided. In time, the plants thickened at the stems and grew new leaves. She planted rows of lettuce, beetroot, and carrots. She cleared the rubble from the ornamental pond. It was good to feel the soil under her nails and nurture something again. Chapter 18. Harold and the Decision.
Good afternoon. I'm ringing about a patient called Queenie Hennessy. She sent me a letter just over 4 weeks ago.
On the 26th day, and 6 miles south of Stroud, Harold decided to stop. He had retraced the 5 miles to Bath, and kept walking from there for a further 4 days along the A46. But the mistake he had made about his direction deeply disturbed him, and the going was hard. Hedgerows reduced to ditches and dry stone walls. The land opened out and stretched to the left and right. Giant pylons marched as far as he could see. He observed these things, but felt no interest as to why they occurred. Whichever way he looked at it, the road was something that never stopped, and never yielded its promise. It took every scrap of himself to keep moving when he knew in his heart he could not make it. Why had he wasted so much time looking at the sky and the hills, and talking to people and thinking about life and remembering, when all along he could have been in a car? Of course he couldn't do it in yachting shoes. Of course Queenie couldn't keep living, just because he had told her to do so. Every day the sky hung low and white, lit by a silvery spoke of sunlight. He lowered his head so that he would not see the birds swooping overhead, or the traffic passing in a flash. He felt more lonely and left behind than he would have done up a faraway mountain. In making his decision, he wasn't only thinking of himself. There was Maureen, too. He missed her more and more. He knew he had lost her love, but it was wrong to walk out and leave her to pick up the pieces. Already he had caused her too much sorrow. And there was David. In the days since Bath, Harold had felt a painfully long distance from him. He missed them both. Finally, there was the money. The guest houses had been cheap, but all the same he couldn't afford to keep spending like this. He had checked his account at the bank and been shocked. If Queenie was still alive, and if she was interested in a visit, he would take the train. He could be in Berwick by the evening. The woman on the other end of the line said, "Have you rung before?" He wondered if she was the same nurse with whom he had left his original message. This voice was Scottish, he thought, or was it Irish? He was too tired to know. "Could I talk to Queenie?"
"I'm very sorry, but I'm afraid you can't."
It was like hitting a wall he hadn't seen. "Is she..." His chest was smarting. "Is she..." He couldn't say it.
"Are you the gentleman who's travelling by foot?"
Harold swallowed something sharp. He said that yes, he was. He apologised.
"Mr. Fry, Queenie has no family, no friends. When people have no one to stay for, they tend to pass quickly. We have been hoping for your call."
"I see." He could barely speak. He could only listen. Even his blood was still and cold.
"After you rang, we all noticed the change in Queenie. It was very marked."
He saw a body on a stretcher, stiff with not living. He felt what it was to be too late to make a difference. He said with a hoarse whisper,
"Yes."
And then, since she said nothing, he said again,
"Well, of course."
He slumped his forehead against the glass of the booth, followed by his palm, and closed his eyes. If only it was simple to stop feeling. The woman gave a fluttery noise, like a laugh, but it surely couldn't be.
"We've never seen anything like it. Some day she sits up. She shows us all your postcards."
Harold shook his head, not understanding. "I'm sorry?"
"She's waiting, Mr. Fry, like you said she should."
A cry of joy shot out of him and took him by surprise. "She's alive? She's getting better?" He laughed, not meaning to, but it grew bigger, spilling out in waves as tears moistened his cheeks. "She's waiting for me?" He threw open the door of the kiosk and punched the air.
"When you rang and told us about your walk, I was afraid you'd misunderstood the gravity of things. But you see, I was wrong. It's a rather unusual kind of healing. I don't know how you came up with it, but maybe it's what the world needs. A little less sense and a little more faith."
"Yes, yes." He was still laughing. He couldn't stop.
"May I ask how the journey is going?"
"Well, very well. Yesterday, or maybe the day before, I stayed in Old Sodbury. I also passed Dunkirk. Now I believe I'm in Nailsworth." Even that was funny. The voice was chuckling, too.
"One wonders where these names all come from. When should we expect you?"
"Let me think." Harold blew his nose and mopped the last of his crying away. He looked at his watch, wondering how quickly he could get a train and how many different connections it would take. Then, once again, he pictured the space between himself and Queenie, the hills, the roads, the people, the sky. He saw them as he had done on that first afternoon. But now there was a difference. He placed the image of himself among them. He was a little broken, a little tired, his back to the world. But he wouldn't let Queenie down. "In about 3 weeks, possibly more or indeed less."
"Goodness," the voice laughed. "I'll tell her that.
And tell her not to give up. Tell her I will keep walking." He was laughing again, because she was too.
"I'll tell her that too.
Even when she is afraid, she must wait. She must keep living."
"I believe she will. God bless you, Mr. Fry."
For the rest of the afternoon, Harold walked, and into the dusk. The violent doubt he had felt before phoning Queenie was gone. He had escaped a great danger. There were miracles, after all. If he had got on a train, or in a car, he would be on his way, believing he was right. But all the time, it would be wrong. He had nearly given up. But something else had happened, and he kept going. He wouldn't try to give up again. The road led from Nailsworth, past the old mill buildings, and into the outskirts of Stroud. As it dipped towards the centre, he passed a row of red-brick terraced houses, one with scaffolding and ladders and a skip of building rubble parked in the road. A shape caught his eye. On stopping and pushing aside several pieces of plywood, he found a sleeping bag. He gave it a shake to blow off the dust, and although it was ripped and the padding bulged like a soft white tongue from the hole, the tear was only superficial and the zip was still intact. Harold rolled the sleeping bag into a bundle and walked to the house. There were already lights downstairs. When he heard Harold's story, the owner called his wife, and they also offered a fold-up chair, a tea's maid, and a yoga mat. Harold assured them that the sleeping bag was more than enough. The wife said, "I do hope you'll be careful. Only last week our local petrol station was held up by 4 men with guns." Harold promised he was vigilant, although he had come to trust in the basic goodness of people. The dusk deepened and settled like a layer of fur on the outlines of the roofs and trees. He watched the squares of buttery light inside the houses, and people going about their business. He thought of how they would settle in their beds and try to sleep through their dreams. It struck him again how much he cared, and how relieved he was that they were somehow safe and warm.